Hello once again. Welcome back to Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Ray Graff. This afternoon, we welcome astronomer Bob Berman to the studio. He will answer your astronomy-related questions. He is a great guest to have because he knows what he's talking about, and he makes it possible for you and me to understand. It's great. 800-348-2551 is the telephone number. 1-800-348-2551. Okay. Get in early, because once we get the calls going, it can sometimes be tough to get in. 800-348-2551. Mr. Berman, welcome back, sir.
Thank you, Greg. Great to be here, Ray.
And you were just in Alaska with a group, eh?
Oh, yes. By luck, we were there during that week, last week, when it was so warm here. It was 18 below there.
Oh, boy. Well, I hope you had your long johns.
Yeah, but the group, we're very happy because the group got to see fabulous auroras, or aurorae.
Mm-hmm.
And that's all we cared about, that they get what they came for.
So you had a really good display, at least one night.
Oh, yes, one night. The sky just erupted from 2 o'clock in the morning until dawn.
Mm.
It was darn cold. We were in the middle of nowhere. If you stick a pin into the middle of Alaska, you get to Fairbanks, and we were 2 hours outside of Fairbanks. About 9 people from our listening area, too, was part of that 45-person group. And it was great.
That's great. And you, did you do the eclipse trip yet? You talked about it last month.
No, that's going to come up in November. November 13th is the total eclipse. That's in Australia. We actually have.
That's a schlep.
I'd love some of our listeners to join us there. I don't think we have anybody from our region on that. There's, I think, even still a couple of places open. It's Berman Astronomy Tours. I guess I should just mention.
Well, I'll tell you, that would be a great trip. That's.
Yeah, we're going to go. We're not just going to see the total solar eclipse. Inshallah, if the weather is clear.
Yeah.
But penguins in the south and jungles in the north and the Great Barrier Reef. And we're even going to sleep over in the outback. Some ranchers are taking our group in. And we're just going to spend the night out in the middle of nowhere in the desert.
Good times. The number to call here is 800-348-2551. Bob Berman is our guest. 800-348-2551. Before we get to the calls, settle this for me. I was out. My children and I were out looking at the sky the other night, and somebody asked me how many planets one can see with the naked eye. As you know, we've had some issues getting the telescope to work. So we use the naked eye. And I said, I'm not sure you can see those, Uranus, Neptune.
And Pluto. You can't see those. But
even if it was clear and you were in no light pollution zone?
Well, Uranus gets as bright as magnitude 5.7, so you can dimly see it to the naked eye. I have in our no light zones, in our listener area. But you'd have to know which one of the super faint stars that's been chugging from Capricornus toward Aquarius in the last few years, which of those little tiny, tiny, tiny dim stars, of which there seem to be thousands in the sky, it is. So you'd need a star chart. The others, there are 5 traditional bright planets that everybody knew about for thousands of years. Mercury's too low, but this is a rare time when all the rest are simultaneously visible. Everybody knows about Venus because it's been UFO bright.
It is bright.
In the West. We're going to be sad when it's gone. It's going to be gone soon. It's hard to believe because it's so bright and so high right now.
But not really gone, just dimmer?
No, it's going to plunge down, Ray. Every single evening, it's going to be lower and lower and lower and lower until by the end of next month. That's not long. We're talking about 5 weeks from now. Gone. And then the evening sky after the sun sets, instead of having this brilliant shadow casting, dazzling, glorious thing there, there'll be nothing. And it's going to be gone. And next year it's going to be gone for the whole year. So that's bye-bye Venus. Below Venus, way below Venus right now, is Jupiter.
And it was much closer a month or two ago.
Yeah, we've been watching it. Remember, play tag. First, Jupiter was higher than Venus, and then it was side by side, and now it's quite a distance below it, but still visible. And then we have the other two planets, Mars and Saturn, both very nicely visible. I'd say the best way to find Mars is at nightfall. Look about halfway up the southern sky. If you know the constellations, look to Leo. If you don't know the constellations, follow the Big Dipper's pointer stars, the ones that famously point to the North Star.
Yeah.
Go the wrong way. Go the opposite way with them, and they take you to Mars. They take you to Leo.
And it's a little orangish.
Yes, exactly. And it's right near the beautiful main star of Leo named Regulus, which is blue. So you have an orange and blue color contrast.
New York Mets.
You just
perfect.
Like our high school colors.
Well, that's great. Now, what about Saturn? Now, I don't know. I'm sure I've seen it, but I didn't know I saw it.
Okay, here's how you find Saturn. Again, you look toward Venus. Nobody can miss that at nightfall. It's the brightest thing in the sky. It's in the direction of where the sun set. And then you do an about face so that you're facing now the east. Venus is in the northwest, yep. So now you're facing the southeast. And there's another pair of stars of about the same brightness. In fact, there are only two stars down there in the lowish in the southeast. One is another blue star named Spica, the brightest star of Virgo.
Okay.
And next to it is Saturn, two stars of the same brightness. So these days you can find Saturn easily, find Mars, find Venus and Jupiter. And come back a few months from now, in the summertime, there's going to be nothing. So this is the time. It's a cornucopia of planets.
You know, my ineptitude with a telescope already well known. But if I knew how to work a telescope, how good of a telescope would I need to be able to see the rings of Saturn?
You need 30 power, which isn't that
much.
No,
it isn't.
And the rings are better than they've looked in the last 5 years because they changed their tilt. And they've been almost edgewise just a few years ago. Now the angle is opening up more and more. And Saturn is just glorious. It was at its closest to Earth on the 15th. So we're talking about just earlier this week.
Okay.
For the whole year. And it doesn't change that much from day to day. So this week, next week, for the next month, you see Saturn at its biggest and best and brightest of not only the year, but it hasn't been this good in 5 years. So this is the time.
So 30 power, can you get binoculars that could do that?
No, and binoculars with 30 power would be wobbly and shaky. So you really need a telescope, but even a little cheap Kmart telescope. Is Kmart even in existence?
Yes, they are, and I hope they don't sue you. And remember, it's Bob Berman, Skyman Bob.
Through any telescope.
All right, well, we'll give it a shot. Maybe next time I'll report back. Let's go to the phones, 800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. And Doe and Wendell, you're on.
Hi, I've been seeing, once in a while, I've seen the moon at about a quarter moon in the broad daylight. I was wondering what conditions would allow this to happen. What phase of the moon and how often does it happen?
Well, it happens every month because as the moon goes around us, it doesn't care whether it's day or night for us as our planet twirls around. So the moon is actually out in the daytime just as much as it's out at night. And when you say a quarter moon, you probably mean the moon that looks like a half moon, right?
Yes.
And you're using it correctly. I wanted to make sure that you were right about that because only in astronomy does a quarter and a half mean the same thing.
Why?
Because it's like a baseball diamond. A quarter moon is one quarter of the way around its orbit. So that's like first base, and the full moon is second base. And then the third quarter moon is third base. And then a new moon is home plate
as it's
going around. So it's one quarter of its orbit. But it looks like half. It looks like somebody sawed it in half.
Yeah.
So the half moon, quarter moon, same thing. And so our caller is quite right. Doe is quite right. Here's another reason why you keep spotting it, Doe, is that when it's a half moon, whether the waxing half, that is the first quarter moon, which is the one you see in the evening time around dinner time, that's the one that's at its highest at sunset. So that's the one everyone sees. Or the last quarter moon, which is very seldom seen because it doesn't even rise till midnight, and it gets at its highest at sunrise when fewer people are watching. Either one of those sits in the darkest part of the daytime sky. So when you see them in the sky, you're seeing the darkest blue behind them, which makes them stand out more than any other phase of the moon. So they really pop out at you. As I say, the first quarter moon at dinner time, and the last quarter moon in the morning. If you get up and you're mowing the lawn, which we're all going to have to do, I guess, in another month or so, or you're out on your way to work, there it'll be at its highest early morning.
All right.
thank you very much.
Well,
thank you very much.
And goodbye. Let's go over to Maureen in New Paltz. Oh, Maureen is going to be with us in a moment. Our call screener, Christy Carton, now has Maureen ready. Maureen, are you there?
Yes, hi. Bob?
Yes.
Yes, this is Maureen from New Paltz. I'm calling because I want to give you an opportunity to tell folks about the big upcoming event on June 5th, the Transit of Venus, and mm-hmm. also to let the public know, I'm sure that many colleges will be sponsoring viewings of this event, which, as you know, isn't going to be happening again until I think
21-17.
Right. So SUNY New Paltz is joining with the Mid-Hudson Astronomical Association, and they're going to be having an event which will include live streaming, I believe, from Mauna Kea in case we get clouded out. And I just wanted to give you an opportunity to tell folks about why this event is so important, and also to say that I got excited about it when I read about it in your book on the sun.
Ah, well.
And how different nations had launched huge expeditions just to find out the value of an astronomical unit.
Yes.
So the whole thing is fascinating to me.
I'll tell you what, Maureen. Yeah, thanks a lot. You know, we have a break coming up, but you're going to tell me and everybody else what the heck the Transit of Venus is, and we will find out with Bob Berman, and we'll get back to your calls at 800-348-2551 right after we take a short break.
Support for WAMC comes from Reform Pilates Studio, Saratoga Springs, New York, teaching Romana's Pilates, providing a fully equipped studio with Gratz apparatus, private, semi-private, and small group classes. ReformYourBody.com for more information. Pica's Farm Table, makers of quiches, soups, and pestos using fresh local ingredients, found in specialty food stores and farm markets throughout the Hudson Valley, Pica'sQuiche.com. Ashokan Center, Olive Bridge, New York, hosting a symposium on fostering empathy in our schools with David Levine, Jim Liu, and Priscilla Prutzman, May 11th, 8 a.m. to 3 p.m., lunch included, ashokencenter.org. And A.D. George Construction, for over 25 years, serving the Pioneer Valley's residential construction need, remodeling, additions, kitchens, bathrooms, porches, home office space, and more, from the design and planning to its completion, 413-256-6752.
One 800 348 2551 is our telephone number. 800-348-2551. The Astronomy Show on Vox Pop today. Bob Berman is our guest. Bob's latest book is The Sun's Heartbeat. It's on Little Brown, and it's a cracking good read. Easy to read, too, if you're interested in learning about the sun. So we talked. Maureen from New Paltz mentioned the transit of Venus on June 15th. What is it, Bob?
Well, this is the last time anyone who is alive today is going to see Venus essentially eclipse the sun. It's going to pass across the face of the sun. Well, because Venus, although it's almost the size of Earth, is so far away, it's going to appear small, but large enough to see with the naked eye. So if you have sun protection, a solar filter, and if you don't have one, you could go to your favorite welding supply store and get a shade number 12 or shade number 14.
Okay, you mean filter. Look at the sun with the naked eye?
That's what we're going to do. But you can't just stare at the sun with the naked eye because your retina can turn to carbon and smoke can come out of your ears.
Yeah, I thought that's what you did. You didn't do that.
We don't want to do that. So we need the kind of filter you'd need for a eclipse. They're available online for a few cents each. Or I like it because it's really clear, gives a nice clear view. A welder's goggle. You don't even need the whole goggle unless you're going to be repairing your car at the same time. You just need the replacement filter, which is just a few dollars. But make sure you get number 12 or number 14.
And that screens the UV or whatever it is that...
Yes, you can stare at the sun forever with those things. And then on that day, and we are going to see the... little disk of Venus parading across the sun's face that afternoon. We're talking about June 5th. So it's coming up not too far from now. And as the caller mentioned, we're going to have events all over the country for this because it's the last time it will happen. Now, the very best way to see it, I guess I should also mention that Mohawk Mountain House down in New Paltz is going to have a special viewing event. We're going to have hundreds of people watching it together. We're going to broadcast that live. I'll be there to run an event at Mohawk. But colleges and other places probably around the world is going to run it because, by happy chance, we are on the right side of the earth. Everybody gets to see it as long as the sun is in their sky when it happens. So if it's nighttime when it happens, you're out of luck. It won't be. It'll be late afternoon for us, so we're going to see about half of it, which is good enough. Goes on for about 6 hours. We're going to see half of it. And you don't even need more than that because slowly this dot of Venus is going to cross the sun's face. My favorite way to view it, frankly, is to get that solar filter, get that welder's goggle, and very carefully duct tape it to the front of binoculars. Not the end you look through, but the end with the big lens.
Yeah.
Carefully and
securely.
Securely is the key. Now, if you can't do it securely, don't do it, because you don't want to be looking at the sun for even a fraction of a second while this thing falls off.
Right.
So if you feel you can do it so that it's idiot-proof and that you can pass it out to kids without any chance of ruining their eyes, you don't want to blind anyone, that would be the very best way to see it, because then you'll see Venus crystal clear crossing the sun's face that day on June 5th. So I'll be having some solar telescopes set up so we can actually view it, but I've just told you the best way to see it.
Yeah.
If you're confident enough, and you know, don't mess with your eyesight, don't mess with your kid's eyesight, but if you're confident about doing this, you can certainly secure it so that it's rock solid. You just have to make sure you've done that.
Now, when was the first time in history it was noted?
In the 15th century.
How did they do that?
Well, back then it was Jeremiah Horrigan who first saw it in England, who predicted it, and he was the only one in the world. He and a friend of his was the first person to see it. And then he died tragically at age 21 of an unknown cause. So his friend then became, for all of his life, the only one on Earth who had ever seen one. But then they became really good after Edmund Halley of Halley Comet fame realized that, hey, if you have a couple of people in different parts of the world, the more the better, timing it, they can triangulate Venus's distance from the sun and the sun's distance and figure out for the first time how far away the sun really is. And everybody wanted to know how far away the sun is because all the rest of the planets would then fall into place too.
Right.
We would know cosmic distances. So it became so important that England and 13 other countries launched expeditions to the other side of the world, to Tahiti, to observe the eclipse, and in China. And boy, they had adventures. One fellow, part of the French team, went to India, and then it was cloud. And no, it was worse than that. He arrived late because of all the visa troubles and getting through countries. He arrived late, and he missed the transit. Well, fortunately, they happened in pairs 8 years apart. So there was going to be one in 8 years. So he spent 8 years waiting in India for the next transit. And then thanks to an early monsoon, it was cloudy. So he didn't even get to see that. So there have been travails. They come in pairs separated by over a century. So we've now had a pair, first in 2004, on June 8th. We had a pair and we got to see it because it was clear that day. And now it's 8 years later. So now we have the second and final member of the pair coming up on June 5th. And then no more again until 2117.
I'm still trying to figure out how the guy in the 15th century looked at it without becoming blind.
Back then they would use colored glass or smoke glass. They'd take a candle flame and they'd smoke some glass and then be able to look at the sun that way.
All right, let's go back to the phones. 800-348-2551. Bob Berman is our guest. 800-348-2551. Ed in Salt Point. Ed, you're on.
Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
Quick follow-up on the transit of Venus question there. Nope, I forgot that one.
All right.
Okay. I just want to shift gears for a moment because I know you take these kinds of questions and ask a cosmological question. Are you familiar with Leonard Krauss and his recent book and on how something can come from nothing.
No, tell me about it.
Oh, dear. Okay, well, you're familiar with Lenny Strauss, the physicist.
And what does he say?
Well, he says through quantum physics, if you just do the math in quantum physics, you can satisfactorily come to the conclusion that something can come from nothing.
Oh, yes. Now I remember that.
Ringing bells? Okay, fine.
Yes.
Okay, I actually have not read the book. I saw the YouTube presentation, which is a very extensive presentation. Okay, I just wondered if you had any comments on that.
Yep, okay. Here's the thing. You know, sometimes these very, very smart people, these theorists, get almost too smart for their own good. And through equations, I don't know if you know this, but you can actually prove that 1 and 1 is 3 mathematically if you just do it the right way. And you can show that that essentially there's nothing here at all in the universe. We're looking around at nothingness. And the way they do this is like this. They consider all of mass and gravity to be a positive thing. And energy, dark energy, which is repulsive, to be negative. And so ultimately, the positives and the negatives cancel out. And then they state that fundamentally there is nothing. And so the universe popped in out of nothingness.
And a little, yes. Okay.
Now, a little bit of background to this, too, is that we observe virtual particles snapping in and out of emptiness. Actually, we haven't observed them. They're still theoretical. But everybody believes in them, that in there's no such thing as absolute nothingness, and that even the emptiness of space has virtual particles that under the right circumstances, for example, if there's a nearby electrical or magnetic field, they can borrow some of this energy and become permanently real, sort of like Pinocchio coming into life. So there is a sort of a basis for thinking that out of emptiness you can get stuff. But since you wanted my opinion on it, my opinion is that, come on, you can't get a universe from real nothingness. We're looking around and the observable universe weighs 10 followed by 50 zeros metric tons. It's an awful lot of stuff there, the mass energy of the universe. Are you really going to get all of this from true nothingness? I think it's almost silly talk. So okay. You wanted my opinion. There it is.
Okay, thank you. I remember my transit of Venus question. It was a simple one.
Go ahead, please.
Is it going to be tracked on SLU?
Yes, definitely. We're going to have definite shows from SLU. And one of the tracks we're going to have on SLU is, in fact, is presenting Mohawk Mountain House and the crowds there watching it. But we're also going to have telescopes set up in Hawaii that are going to be showing the whole thing.
Okay, well, thank you very much. Appreciate it.
Thanks very much. 1-800-348-2551 is the telephone number. 1-800-348-2551. So then, if something cannot come from nothing, in your view, the Big Bang was not nothing. It was everything in one little tiny point, right? So the Big Bang is still in play for you.
Big Bang is in play, except its nature has changed over the last 10 years, Ray, because since the late 1990s, more and more evidence is pointing to an infinite universe. And if the universe is infinite, it means that the Big Bang was not the beginning of everything, but was a local event. That was the creation of what we might call the observable universe, the stuff that we can see. And it seems more and more likely that the universe has neighborhoods, maybe even with different fundamental properties. For example, the electromagnetic constant called alpha, which we assume, and which Einstein, if Einstein is right, and he is true everywhere, there's some increasing evidence that it has a different value when you look far into the distance to the north than in the south, and a different value long ago. All of this is suggesting that, especially with an infinite universe, that the huge universe that we see, the observable universe, is one neighborhood in an infinite matrix. Mm. Now, because I'm not big on just saying stuff that doesn't have any basis, I can tell you that hard evidence, some of which has just emerged 2 weeks ago in the giant study done at Berkeley of 900,000 galaxies. And I just spoke to Shirley Ho, who is one of the lead investigators there, and she confirmed that all of this evidence is pointing to an infinite universe. That, baryonic acoustic oscillations, the flat topology of space, the ratio of dark matter to baryonic matter. There's a lot of different avenues of solid evidence that are all pointing to an infinite universe.
What is baryonic matter?
Baryonic matter means the stuff in our bodies and on our planet, things made of ordinary atoms, okay. Baryons, as opposed to dark matter.
I see.
All of this is pointing, is increasingly heading in that direction. So our question is, where does the Big Bang fit into an infinite universe? And right now, the best way to visualize this is that the Big Bang was a local event, but not the whole event. Not to mention that an infinite universe probably didn't even have a birth.
Well, if it's infinite, then what we see is 0% of it, right?
Yes. That's so crazy that everything we may observe, everything we can ever observe, any percentage of infinity is zero.
Oh.
So even the galaxies that are within view, and there are 200 billion galaxies within view of our best telescopes, all of these represent 0% of the actual universe.
Wow. Let's go to Casey in East Greenbush. Casey, you're on.
Hi, it's Katie.
Oh, Katie, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
All right. I'm just wondering if we are a part of the Milky Way galaxy. I'm wondering how it is that we know what it looks like if we're inside of it.
That's a big question and a long-standing question. We're like worms trapped inside. We've never, people wonder, well, how far have we gone? We haven't even gotten to the nearest star, the closest star, 4.3 light years away, let alone to the outskirts of the galaxy, 100,000 light years from us. And even then, it wouldn't show us the galaxy. We'd probably have to step outside at least 500,000 light years to be able to look back and see its shape. So we have to infer it, one, from looking at other galaxies, and we can tell that we're in a spiral galaxy, mostly from the hydrogen that's here. So we see also from the Milky Way, you know, on a clear night in our area, you see that Milky Way cutting the sky in half, running like a stream of spilt milk. So that's our first clue. It means that the stars and the distant stuff are concentrated in a flat plane, like a DVD or a pancake. Otherwise, we wouldn't see this Milky Way completely surrounding us. So we know we're in a flat-shaped object made up of at least 100 billion stars and probably 400 billion stars. And we see other pancake objects around us in space, so we know we probably look like them. But the real evidence is when we map out the hydrogen, which we can do with radio telescopes, and that shows us the spiral shape.
Ah. Wow. And where are we? In an arm?
We're in an arm. We're a little outskirt from the Orion arm, a little sub stream that comes out of one of the arms, located about 25,000 light years from the center, which means that we're closer to 60 to 70,000 light years from the edge.
Okay.
Of the, yep.
All
there
right.
It is.
Okay.
Well, Katie, thanks a lot for the call.
Well, thank you.
So by the way, 800-348-2551 is the telephone number. Bob Berman is our guest. It's the Astronomy Show, 800-348-2551. So we are closer to the center of the Milky Way than we are the edge.
We're actually, considering it's 100,000 light years across and we're 25,000 from the center, we'd be probably halfway to the edge. And the reason I'm putting it at a different distance is because we're finding out more and more of the halo that surrounds us, that we found that our spiral galaxy is kind of like a ship in a bottle, that there's a lot more stuff that we can't see that extends the galaxy further than we suspected. So
okay.
you have to take that into consideration, too.
All right. And in the center of every galaxy, it is supposed there is a black hole?
Yep. Exactly right. A supermassive black hole. An ordinary garden variety black hole might weigh the same as 10 suns or 12 suns or 20 suns. The one in the middle of our Milky Way galaxy weighs 4 million suns.
Okay.
And even that is not anything to write home about because it's one of the lighter weight of the supermassive black holes in other galaxies. The all-time winner is an 8 billion solar mass black hole that sits at the center of a ball-shaped galaxy, which is really the Times Square of our part of space. That's the middle of everything in our region of the galaxy called M87. And in the middle of that, there is the all-time winner supermassive black hole.
And is the black hole, at least this is the way I picture it, the black hole is the engine that makes the galaxy go? In other words, in addition to eventually sending it to its demise, it is what makes the galaxy run?
No, not really. It may have been the glue that started the galaxy's protostars glommed onto it and held enough material so that more and more stars form. There's still a little bit of doubt as to whether galaxies come first, that is, globs of gas that stars form out of, because we do see that happening, or whether it's stars that form separately and then get pulled in, each of them surrounding a supermassive black hole. But in either case, don't worry about, not that you're worrying, but
no.
About the black hole sucking things in. That's bad press that black holes
okay.
have. They don't really do that at all, because they just don't do that. For example, if our sun collapsed a minute from now to be a black hole, and it can't because you have to weigh at least 4 solar masses, and our sun weighs 1 solar mass by definition. If it collapsed to be a black hole, we'd still orbit just like before. We wouldn't be pulled in the slightest bit because it has the same gravity that it did before it collapsed, and it's only its gravity balancing with ours that produces our orbit. So no problem.
Okay.
Nothing really gets sucked into a black hole unless it's really, really close to begin with.
All right, fair enough. So the black hole needs a new agent. 800-348-2551, the telephone number. Let's take a short break. We'll get back to the phones with Bob Berman coming up on Vox Pop.
Support for Vox Pop comes from David Stein and Charles Padula, DDS, Union Avenue, Schenectady. Cosmetic dentistry, including Invisalign, where teeth can be orthodontically moved without braces. DavidSteinDDS.com. The Arkell Museum at Canajoharie, featuring the exhibition Rising from the Sea, The Art of J. Hall Conaway, Landscapes and Seascapes from New England, through May 20th, ArkellMuseum.org. And the Unitarian Universalist Congregations of the Capital Region, using many sources of wisdom in their Sunday services, including the words of Emerson and Thoreau, Native Americans, and the Bible, CapitalRegionUU.org. And Mango Tree Imports Boston Spa, New York, celebrating its 6th year anniversary during Boston Spa's First Friday celebration, May 4th, 6 to 9 p.m., MangoTreeImports.com.
The one and only Bob Berman, our guest. It's Vox Pop, 800-348-2551. Back to the phones we go, and Ursula in Ghent. Ursula.
Yes.
Hi.
This is the first time I ever do that, and please wish me luck. I'm not a good talker. But I'm calling about the gentleman and the theory about the Big Bang and what the quantum physicists said. They came to the thinking that something can come from nothing. And in my humble opinion, and I'm convinced of it, I'm not surprised about what they found, because if we open our thinking to the fact that we always think just in everything that involves matter, and which is all over, we are filled out with it, the whole world is filled out with it. But if we have to find out what is behind matter, what makes matter alive, what is alive in nature, in plants, in animals, in humans, in everything? Who has created the universe? And then I think the question should be, rather, would there be a Big Bang? But the question might be, or should be, at what point in evolution did the spirit attract matter and become visible? That is the important thought.
Well, I don't know if you can. Could you test something like that, Mom?
No, and you know, as soon as you get to the spiritual aspect, I can't, you know, quibble with you because this is a science show, And if you say there's just total emptiness in space, and then bang, from this total emptiness, there comes the universe because of a higher intelligence or something like that. That you know, that's beyond science. All we can go is where the evidence takes us, and the evidence that is the Hubble constant, type 1a supernova flux, baryonic matter versus dark matter, the baryonic acoustic oscillations, the flat topology of space, all of this is leading us, especially in the last 10 years, toward an infinite universe composed of an infinite number of stars and galaxies.
Yes, it is.
And the Big Bang being a local event. Now, what causes the Big Bang? How does the Big Bang arise? The truth is, Ursula, nobody knows.
Now,
you may believe the Big Bang just popped in because, a higher power said, boom, it's time for the Big Bang to arise. And I'm not even going to argue with you and say that can't be. I'm just saying that's a different type of discussion.
So, in other words,
we have in science.
Ursula, if I understand it, then Bob is not precluding the presence of some sort of supreme being. It's just that that's not what he does. So thanks for the call. Let's go to Julie in Schenectady. Julie.
Yes, hi. I have a question. From my reading, I had understood that Einstein had been trying to support the theory of the steady state universe, which had existed for forever and would exist for forever, which sounds to me like your infinite universe that you've been talking about. But he was forced to, in his theory of general relativity, to divide by zero to make it work out. Am I misunderstanding?
No, you're actually quite right. In general relativity, to all of his conclusions were of a universe that had to either expand or collapse. That's the only way general relativity works. But at that time, 1915, it was believed that the universe was static or steady. And so he added this kind of fudge factor, this number. And then from between 1925 and 1929, when it was announced by Edwin Hubble that the universe really is expanding, he realized, and the world realized, that Einstein had predicted at first in his mind with general relativity. And Einstein then told everyone who would listen that was the worst blunder of his life. That was his famous line. It was the worst blunder of my life.
It wasn't a blunder. It was a lie.
Well, he's not the first person who added a fudge factor to make something work.
Fraud, isn't it?
Oh, gosh. All right. Now, in fairness, Albert's not here to defend himself, so I will move on. Let's go to Mary in Poughkeepsie. Mary. Hi.
Just quickly, are you going to have this show on the line if I wanted to hear it tonight?
Absolutely. Yeah, it'll be on the old podcast. About an hour after the program is done, we'll get it up there.
Wait, did you talk about life in other places or
no,
possibly?
Not yet. No.
You're the first.
Go ahead.
No, I won't go there. I want to ask you about something else. There's two theories, and I'm confused. Are they only theories? One says that the universe is expanding and will do so infinitely till the sky is dark. We'll never see another star. We won't have any neighbors. The second theory says that Andromeda Strain is headed for us, and we're going to crash and collide and completely destroy each other. So which is it? We're either going away from each other, or we're coming towards each other.
You're very knowledgeable, and you're right about both things, and they don't contradict each other, and here's why. You're right, Andromeda's coming toward us at 70 miles per second. We're expected to collide in only 4 billion years. But we're not going to destroy each other because stars are so far apart in both of our galaxies that the galaxies will just merge into a new giant ball-shaped galaxy that's even been named. Here's a case of something that's been named before it exists, and it's called Milkcomeda.
How imaginative. Milkcomeda. Wonderful. Those scientists.
So it's coming toward us. And now you're wondering, well, how can it come toward us in an expanding universe? How can galaxies, if they're expanding, why is Andromeda coming toward us? And the reason is, what's expanding, and very few people realize this outside of the sciences, is that our galaxy isn't expanding, And our cluster of galaxies that we live in, made up of about 30 galaxies, three spirals and the rest are small irregular things, we're not expanding. Because clusters of galaxies don't expand. They're like little swarms of bees. They're gravitationally held together. What expands are clusters of galaxies away from other clusters of galaxies. That's the only expansion going on in the universe. So within any cluster, like Andromeda and our own Milky Way, there's not only no expansion, but there's nothing wrong with the galaxies coming toward each other or even merging or colliding. It's just that groups of galaxies are increasing their distance from other groups.
So Andromeda is coming faster than we are moving, or are they moving in a different direction?
We can't tell, Ray, because all we know is that the distance between us and Andromeda is shrinking by 70 miles a second. Now, we can't tell if we're standing still and Andromeda is coming toward us, or if Andromeda is standing still and we're going toward it, because there's no grid system in space by which to measure such distance. Or maybe we could split the distance and say
we're both
we're both moving toward each other.
All right, Mary, thanks a lot for the call. So are we moving toward anything else that you know of, another galaxy?
Yeah, there's about a dozen galaxies that have blue shifts, in other words, that are coming toward us. But they're all in our Virgo cluster of galaxies. They're all in our larger group of galaxies.
Very interesting. We go to Mike and Wendell. Mike, you're on. Hello, Mike.
Yo.
Hey.
Hey, how's it going, buddy?
Good. You're on.
Hi, I'm on. Hey, question. In an infinite universe, are all things true?
I think what you mean is the many worlds interpretation of quantum mechanics, which says that all possibilities can come true. And that's a minority view. Most physicists don't believe that. In that view, just so we all understand what we're talking about, every time there's a choice in nature, like, for example, if you go out on the street and you can either turn left or right, yeah, that's a choice. If you turn left, you've joined a universe in which you have turned left and all the consequences that come from that. But another you in an alternate universe has turned right and has experienced and starts to experience those consequences. And this is true of every single action in life, even those involve just physical things and flies buzzing around. And so by this thinking, there are an infinite number of possible universes that keep branching out, in almost infinite number, and you're only aware of the one in which the events that you remember seeing have occurred. But there are other yous that have that experience these other things. Now, that's most physicists don't buy that. I don't buy this either, but I think that's what you're talking about. So in that kind of a universe, everything is possible.
Wow, that was a very comprehensive answer.
Thank you, Mike. Let's go to David in Saratoga Springs. David, you're on.
Yeah, hi, guys. Hi. I love the topic. Absolutely a space nerd. But my question... Well, I had a question about black holes again, and I've heard theories about how some people think that inside each black hole is a gateway to another universe, and all kinds of things about what happens when you go through a black hole, if, you know, given that you would survive. I'm just curious what your thoughts are, or if that's too speculative.
I'll be happy to do that. And I also want to mention that Mary, I know Mary had another part. She was about to say something exciting. So if she listening,
yeah, call
and
back,
if she
Mary.
Calls, we'll put her back on.
All
because
right,
I know Mary's just about to have, she had something exciting to say. It's driving me crazy.
Okay.
I'm curious about that. So now, David, to answer your question about black holes and being a possible gateway elsewhere, what you're talking about are wormholes, sometimes called the Einstein-Rosen bridge, which is a mathematical or theoretical way that if you actually went into that strong gravitational pull of a black hole, and if Einstein is the only way we can think of black holes, that is, if relativity is right and they really do crush down to infinitely small volume, there could be a mathematical tunnel to other parts of the universe or to other times in the universe. However, more recent analysis has shown that anything of mass, like you or me, would cause that to collapse And so we could not use that as a conduit to other places or other times. And it should also be mentioned that there's a good reason to wonder whether a singularity actually ever forms, and that is a material getting smaller and smaller and denser in a black hole, which is not a hole, because this is not emptiness. This is a place where matter is so packed that we can't even imagine this kind of density, that as it gets smaller and smaller, some physicists think that because infinitely small space, zero volume, and infinitely large density are impossible, they have no physical meaning, that it's just as likely that something stops this process of collapse in the first place, something like, for example, the strong force of nature, the four forces in nature, one of them could take over and prevent this collapse from reaching zero volume, in which case you never could have a wormhole in the first place.
Okay.
So there's a lot of ifs with this.
Has it worked for you, David?
Good enough. Thank you.
Thanks a lot. 800-348-2551 is the telephone number. Bob Berman is our guest. Dan and Beacon is on. Dan.
Hi. I was listening to the Transit of Venus story, and there's a book called Mason and Dixon. In fact, Mason and Dixon, the guys who surveyed the United States, the Maryland line and so on, actually went to Ascension Island and some crazy number, like a year or so, built the observatory, and it was clouded over when the transit happened. Kind of a cute story. And then they came to America and did their surveying.
Let's hope that doesn't happen for us on June 5th.
Yeah, I hope so, too. I'll join you up there. I'm going to be at Mohonk.
Oh, great.
Outstanding.
Fantastic. Great. Great.
Thanks, Dan. We appreciate it.
Thanks.
Yep, we'll see you. Oh, hey, look at this. Mary is back again. Hi, Mary.
Hi, Mary.
Hi, hi. I've been hearing that there's animals that can live in oceans that are very, very cold, like around Antarctic. They can live without hemoglobin. They can have white blood, cloudy blood. And Europa is a moon of Saturn, or one of those big planets that has that ability. They have an underwater, they're massive oceans.
Yes. Under the ice, right?
Yes.
Right. Now, is there any way that we can trace whether life can exist from this point? I know we're having, like, the New Horizons is going past that planet now, and on the outside it's looking in, but it can't really get through the ice.
No, it can't, unfortunately. And to answer your question, New Horizons, which is on its way to Pluto and will arrive there in a few years, is not going to do anything regarding Europa. And unfortunately, the only mission on the drawing board is going to orbit Europa. Many of us are saying, what's the point? The whole idea with Europa, now that we know that there are salt water oceans, warm water there, and we know that life started in Earth's oceans. In fact, even a billion years ago, there was only life in Earth's oceans, even just a billion years ago. So Europa has the same conditions Earth had, salt water, warm water, energy source. So plus, if life got a boost on Earth thanks to comets bringing amino acids to Earth, which many think, so that we didn't have to start from scratch, Europa has had more comets raining down on it over the billions of years with amino acids.
Yeah.
So if you had a bet, you'd almost bet that it's more likely that there is life on Europa's oceans than there isn't. So one of the things that scientists would like to do more than anything else right now is find a way to drill or burn their way through that mile-thick ice and sample those that water under Europa's oceans. But unfortunately, the New Horizons, as you mentioned, is just zooming by it. It's not going to tell us anything. And the planned Europa orbiter, what's the point of orbiting? What are we going to learn from orbiting? Nothing. So nothing yet.
What about ground penetrating radar or something like that?
Well, even that's not going to tell us anything about life.
Yeah.
Unless
it was big life.
That's right, whales.
Yeah.
European whales.
But they're smarter than we are. But what about the salt water? Do we know it's salt?
We know it's salt because there's a little signature of sodium above Europa that indicates that it's salt water. There's also another moon, Enceladus. Europa goes around Jupiter, but Enceladus going around Saturn also has underground oceans of which spray into space. They have geysers of salt water that sprays into space. So that's another place. So now we have an embarrassment of riches.
All right, Mary, we are now officially out of time. So thanks for the call. And You know, if you were to drill into Europa, don't you then compromise the experiment?
Well, you'd have to bring a certainly a sterile experiment. Unlike, remember the surveyor the moon, the robot surveyor spacecraft. When Apollo 12 went to the moon, the astronauts hopped over. The mission was deliberately landed within a few hundred yards of the surveyor. They snipped off some material to see how the foam and on the rest fared after 2.5 years in the moon. And you know what? They brought it back, and there was a living streptococcus.
Oh, you're kidding me.
That had survived 2.5 years with no water, with the tremendous heat, over 200 degrees, on the moon's airless surface, and it was still alive.
Remind me. Next time you're on, we got to talk about that. That is it for today. Thanks to everybody who called in. Sorry if you didn't make it through. Zach Molloy, our engineer, Christy Carton answered the phones. Support comes from Hildene, the Lincoln Family Home, Manchester, Vermont, Historic Home, Pullman Car, Museum Store, and Walking Trails, open daily year-round, 9:30 to 4:30, Hildene.org. The Lake George Land Conservancy, Bolton Landing, New York, working to permanently preserve the natural, scenic, and recreational resources of the Lake George region since 1988, lglc.org. And Wild Birds Unlimited Nature Shop, Saratoga Springs, New York, featuring Tilly hats with a UPF 50 sun protection rating and a lifetime guarantee, available in winter and summer styles for men and women, wbu.com/Saratoga Springs. Thanks to the great Bob Berman. I am Ray Graff. Next week on Medical Monday, Dr. Hamish Kerr of Albany Medical Center will join Alan to talk about sports medicine. Stay tuned now for a news update.